Thanks very much for the generous excuse to give the following lecture in the Applied series. Let's see. All right, so I'm afraid I'm going to continue from last time, so there'll be very minimal motivation, and I'll just start stating theorems with the notation from last time. All right, so we're first we're going to work in Cm omega of Rn, and we're going to fix m and n bigger than or equal to 1. There was some amusement last time about the fact that m is 4. Anyway, m needn't be 4. Okay. Omega is a modulus of continuity. This is the space of functions with of CM functions whose nth derivatives have modulus of continuity omega. And omega is assumed to be a regular modulus of continuity, and that's a very minimal assumption, but I won't go through the definition again. Okay, so for this problem, let me state the version of the theorem that involves error bars. So this is going to be the first theorem, and it's the easiest theorem of this kind because we're working in Cm omega instead of the much harder Cm, and we don't yet have Whitney convex sets. We just have errors for function values. So the theorem is a confirmation of the finiteness principle from last time, and so it says there exist constants K and C depending only on M and N, such that the following holds. Okay. Suppose we're given an approximation problem. So what is an approximation problem of the sort we're considering? So suppose we're given first of all, we're given omega, a regular modulus of continuity. That tells us which space we're working in. Okay. We're given a set E contained in Rn. Okay. And we're given functions F, sometimes called phi in the last lecture, f taking e to the reals and sigma taking e to the non-negative reals. Remember, this is the mean and this is the standard deviation of an experiment. Okay, so we're given such things, and let's say we're given a constant m. Well, let's see, is that enough? All right. Now, let's assume, so that's what we're given, and we assume that for any k points, x1 to xk in the set E, we can solve the approximation problem that we want with a uniform constant simply for these k points. Okay? So we assume, give for any one of these, there exist nth degree polynomials, p1, to pk, so remember the script p is the space of nth degree polynomials on Rn, such that these are plausible Taylor polynomials for a solution of the approximation problem where we're expanding about these points. So first of all, oh, you know what, let's take two constants, m1 and m2, bigger than zero. And let's say here, all right, first of all, if we differentiate the ith polynomial a few times at xi, that's less than or equal to m1. So this is for alpha less than or equal to m and I running from 1 to k. Same, I'm sorry? Same, the same I. So for each point xi, pi is what I think the Taylor expansion of the function is going to be. And so this says that it's a CM1 function at I mean, this is what I would expect if it's a CM1 function with bound at most M1. CM, I'm sorry, what did I say? Oh, CM. Good. Thank you. Okay, so that. And then the next point is that if you compare two different Taylor expansions, two different alleged Taylor expansions, like that, okay, this is less than or equal to M1 times omega of xi minus xj times xi minus xj to the m minus alpha for alpha less than or equal to m, and let's say 0 less than xi minus xj less than or equal to 1. So if any two points are close together, their Taylor expansions ought to agree quite well, and this is simply what you would get from Taylor's theorem with remainder if you assume that a function belongs to this class CM omega with norm at most M1. Okay, and finally, these polynomials are supposed to be the alleged Taylor polynomials, not merely of any nice smooth function. We could so far take them all to be zero and be perfectly happy, but they should satisfy the approximation property, namely that if you look at pi of xi and compare it with what it's supposed to be, that it's within, let's say, M2 standard deviations. And this happens for I equals 1 to k. All right. Let me ask an important question. We're on a schedule. The Fields Institute is on a schedule. It's probably important to stop just at the right time. When is that?
Before
3:30. Before 3:30. Wow. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Strictly before 3:30. Okay. All right. All right. So notice the role of the constants M1 and M2. M1 is telling you how big the CM omega norm of the alleged function is supposed to be, and M2 is telling you how many standard deviations are allowed for the error. Okay? Yes. Yes. But this is an... All right, so... right, but this is the if of an if then. And so... No. It says assume there exists k. Okay. I'm sorry. Assume that for any x1 to xk. So this is an assumption that depends on k. And as you say, when k is zero, there's nothing to assume. It's a vacuous assumption.
Okay.
When k is getting bigger, this is a stronger and stronger assumption. Okay. And for k large enough, depending only on m and n, it's a strong enough assumption to apply the conclusion.
Okay.
Okay, yes. Okay, so then. That's not a verb, is it? Then there exists a function f in CM omega of Rn. Okay, so here's the verb, I guess. Okay, there. I'm a product of U.S. public education, but I nevertheless, okay. So there exists a function like this, such that, okay, before Bush, yes. I'm one of the children left behind. All right. So there exists a function f with two properties. So first of all, it's CM norm. I'm sorry, it's CM omega norm. Is less than or equal to what it's supposed to be, M1, well, times, I mean, there's some slop, you only estimate the order of magnitude, so here's a constant that depends only on M and N, that's the constant C up there, and the other property is that F of X minus what it's supposed to be is within C times M2 standard deviations for all X in E. That's the statement of the theorem. Okay, now see. Can everybody see the statement of the theorem? Okay. Let's see. All right, now what does this do for you? What this does for you is the following. Suppose that I give you numbers M1 and M2, and I'm not interested in the exact numbers, but only their orders of magnitude. Okay. I would like to know, is there a function whose CM omega norm is so big and which approximates the given data to so many standard deviations? And this theorem makes it possible to calculate whether that can be done. Why do I say calculate? Well, first of all, notice the theorem is necessary and sufficient. I mean, if you can do this, then you can obviously do those three things where I guess the constant C moves to the other side. But as far as orders of magnitude is concerned, the converse of this theorem is obvious. It's just immediate from Taylor's theorem with the remainder. You let the P sub I's be simply the Taylor polynomials of this function f wherever a polynomial is demanded of you. Okay, so this is necessary and sufficient, and furthermore, the hypothesis is checkable. Now, what does it mean that the hypothesis is checkable? Let's fix some particular points, x1 through xk, and let's make ourselves a quadratic form. Let's sum the squares of everything that's supposed to be less than or equal to 1. So let's sum over alpha I of del alpha pi of xi, so we're squaring that. And then let's sum over alpha and suitable I and j of del alpha of pi with minus pj of xj, quantity squared divided by omega of blah, blah, blah. Let's square that also. And then let's sum, what is it? It's okay, let's take that quadratic form. Now, if x1 through xk are fixed, this is a quadratic form in a bunch of p's. And, it's not homogeneous, it has that term in it. So it's a quadratic polynomial in a bunch of p's. And I'm asking, for all of these inequalities to be true, maybe I should divide here by m1 squared, and here I'll put an additional m1, and here I'll put an m2. And so all of these terms are supposed to be less than or equal to 1 in the hypothesis. And so the hypothesis is really telling us that this quadratic form can be made less than or equal to some constant that depends only on M and N and, well, on K, because that determines how many summons there are. But K is depending only on M and N. So what this hypothesis is really telling us is that is that the minimum of this quadratic function is at most C. And that's a linear algebra calculation. So for each particular x1 through xk, we do a linear algebra calculation and we get a number. And then as the x1 through xk vary, we're taking a soup. If k were growing arbitrarily large, this would be a soup of ever larger linear algebra problems, and it would be not fair to say that we can compute it. But since k is some number that depends only on m and n and can be bounded above, it can actually be bounded above by some ridiculous explicit constant explicitly determined by m and n, given that, I think it's fair to say that one can compute whether the hypothesis holds. And so, morally, this is the complete answer to the question, can you interpolate data to a given accuracy with a CM function of a given size? Okay? All right. There's only one case in which the best K is known, and that's the case M equals 1, and it's known that K is then 3 times 2 to the N minus 1. Okay. Now let me tell you, so this is the Brudny-Schwarzman Lipschitz extension, Lipschitz selection business. Okay. Let me tell you the ridiculous upper bound that I have in the general case. So remember there's this space P of all polynomials of degree less than or equal to M. Let's let D be its dimension. And then K is less, I can show that K is less than or equal to D plus 1 to the power 3 times 2 to the D. Or maybe that's 3 times 2 to the D plus 1, I don't remember. So if this is vaguely M, I mean, if this is vaguely M to the N, or, you know, or is it N to the M? What, I mean, it's some, you know, it has an, it's one or the other. And then this is some ridiculous multiple exponential of M and N. Okay. But this is just an artifact of the proof. The best possible K is a question that I know nothing about. Okay. All right. So that's the first result. Now there is a glorified version of this for Whitney convex sets. Let me quickly tell you what a Whitney convex set is, and then state the analog. Yes. Okay. And then, well, all right. Yes. All right. So that's the first theorem. Now we're going to jazz it up, and the motivation for jazzing it up is that it will be a key ingredient in the solution of the problem for CM. Okay. So. All right. So before a function f was considered okay, provided f minus a given function value is less than or equal to a given sigma of x. Now I want to change the meaning of f and sigma, and I'm going to say now that f is okay if at a given if at each point of E, if I look at its full Taylor polynomial, and I subtract off a given polynomial. That belongs to a symmetric convex set of polynomials. Okay? And so I want to describe what kind of sigma is going to be allowed. And so this thing is going to be Whitney convex. And there's going to be then an analog of this theorem 1 for the Whitney convex case. Okay? Oh dear. Over here. All right. So let's fix a point x0 in Rn, and let's remember that R x0 is the ring of jets, the ring of M jets of functions at x0. So it has a multiplication. All right. Now, suppose that we're given sigma contained in R of x0, convex and symmetric about the origin. In the papers I wrote, I assumed it was closed, but that's trivial to, I mean, that is, restriction is trivial to remove. All right. So, given such a thing, and given also a constant A, let me tell you what it means to say that sigma is Whitney convex with Whitney constant A, and so that statement means the following. Suppose we're given a polynomial P that belongs to, I'm sorry, a jet, whatever, a Taylor polynomial, whatever, P, belonging to sigma, and another jet simply belonging to the ring, not necessarily belonging to the convex set, okay? And we're also given a number delta between 0 and 1, and that's a length scale. And this is going to be used when we make partitions of unity on the length scale delta. Okay? So assume that P and Q satisfy the following estimates. Del alpha p of x0 is less than or equal to delta to the m minus alpha. And del alpha q of x0 is less than or equal to delta to the minus alpha for alpha less than or equal to m. Okay, and then the conclusion. That's right, that's right. So I'm defining Whitney convexity, and then I'm going to define Whitney omega convexity. Okay? So far there is no omega. All right, so we assume all this. Then, if you multiply P and Q in the ring of jets, this doesn't belong to sigma anymore, but it belongs to A times sigma. That's the condition. Now, I predicted that you wouldn't like it. There it is. Let me try to make a few remarks to lessen your dislike of it. Okay, so the first remark, I'm going to allow you to dislike it for a little while. Well, I guess I have no power over, right, I'm not going to try to change your mind. For just a little while, I need to define what it means for a function, for a convex set to be Whitney omega convex. So if omega is a regular modulus of continuity, in the sense of last time, then one says that sigma is Whitney omega convex with Whitney constant A. And that means all the same stuff, except that instead of this condition on P, we're assuming that the derivatives satisfy this for the given modulus of continuity. Okay? Now, if you remember the list of innocuous conditions on omega, one of them is that omega is increasing and equal to 1 when delta equals 1. So this factor is always less than or equal to 1. And therefore, whenever sigma is Whitney convex, it is automatically Whitney omega convex for every omega. That's useful later on when we don't know what omega is going to be. Okay. All right, so now let me try to persuade you that this is a worthwhile definition. I think what I'm going to do is give a few examples of sets that are visibly Whitney convex or Whitney omega convex. But I don't really understand the full meaning of this condition. It came out of a machine. Let's see what to do. All right. So the first example is this. Suppose I'm given a function sigma tilde from e into 0 infinity. This is the function as before, the one standard deviation for an experiment. Then we could take the convex set sigma of x to be the set of all p, sigma of x0 is the set of all p such that p of x0 in absolute value is less than or equal to sigma tilde of x0. And it's trivial to check that this thing, that this convex set is Whitney convex with Whitney constant 1. Because simply I don't care about any derivatives of p, I only care about the function values. And if you look at what these estimates are saying, they're saying, well, if p is less than or equal to delta to the m, well, never mind. If p is in sigma, if the function value of p is small, and the function value of q is at most 1, then when you multiply them together, the function value of p times q is again at most whatever. So this is trivially Whitney convex with Whitney constant 1. Okay, so that's one example. The next example is this. suppose that sigma is not merely a convex set. Suppose it's a vector subspace of the polynomials. All right. Well, in that case, the estimates don't matter because you can simply multiply p and q by any small constant you like. And what this is saying is that if p belongs to the subspace sigma, then p times q also belongs to the subspace. That is, this subspace is an ideal. Okay. So what this is saying, if sigma were a subspace and not a convex set, this would be an ideal. And so this definition is somehow a generalization of the idea of an ideal in a ring, but where you take into account estimates and sizes of things. And I'm grateful to Pierre for urging me to say that. Okay, so that's the next example. So ideals in Rx, 0. And let me give one more example. I think maybe the most interesting example. Suppose that I give you a set, some completely arbitrary, horrible set. There it is, E, sitting in Rn, and I give you a point x0, which let's say is very near to E, but maybe not quite in it. The question also makes perfect sense if x0 is in E. Okay. Now, suppose that I tell you that a function is in Cm with norm at most 1, and I also tell you that the function vanishes on E. What does that tell you about the Taylor polynomial there? Well, let's make up a convex set sigma so that what it tells you is that this Taylor polynomial belongs to sigma. So let's say sigma of x0 is the set of all jets at x0 of functions f such that the Cm norm of f is less than or equal to 1 and f equals 0 on E. All right, so I claim that's an interesting convex set. It would be nice to understand it. In fact, from the results that I hope to get through strictly before 3:30, one actually can understand this convex set. That is, you can exhibit an ellipsoid that sits inside sigma of x0 such that if you dilate that ellipsoid by some constant C depending only on M and N, that contains it. And so you really understand what this looks like in the sense of orders of magnitude. In any event, this set is Whitney convex. It's easy to see that this set is Whitney convex. And if I replace the CM norm by the CM omega norm here, then the analogous set would be Whitney omega convex. Okay? So I hope that this shows you that there are some interesting sets that are Whitney convex and some crucial convex set that I am unlikely to get to in the course of the hour is also Whitney convex, and that plays a role in the proof of things. Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, so what it means, right. What on earth am I talking about? Here's what I'm talking about. All right. So let's say that we're interested in this convex set and I'd like to compute it. What does it mean to compute a convex set? Well, as you say, any convex set has an ellipsoid. I mean, it's comparable to an ellipsoid. But then the question is, which ellipsoid? And I claim that I can compute for you a particular ellipsoid that does the job. And so that's what I mean by computing sigma. Sure. Just P, not Q. That's correct. They don't necessarily have interior. Okay. So what do I mean by an ellipsoid? Some of the sides of the ellipsoid might be zero. Exactly. I mean, they could be pancakes. You take a subspace, and then in there you take a normal. Yes. Yes, yes. That's why I chose to take this X0 just slightly outside. Then it's an honest, I mean, it has interior. But for example, if X0 were at the very tip, then it would not, it would not have any interior, but nevertheless, one could compute it. Okay, let me ask, if everyone is just completely snowed or disgusted, then I think I should modify my plan. Are things okay up to this point? Okay, no loud objections. Okay, so now let me write down the statement of the theorem for Whitney convex sets, and then let's abandon CM omega and start talking about CM. Okay, so here, maybe in all fairness to, oh wait, maybe nobody's taking notes anymore. Maybe this is the modern age and everything is on the web. Okay. All right, so I'm going to state theorem 2. All right, so theorem 2, there exists a K depending only on M and N, such that the following holds. All right. So let's suppose we're given omega, regular modulus of continuity, given that, we're given E, an arbitrary subset of Rn, and for each x in E, we're given also an mjet, okay, and sigma of x contained in Rx, this is assumed to be Whitney convex. Whitney omega convex with Whitney constant A, independent of X. Okay, I didn't define the A to be the best possible constant. A is a Whitney constant. Okay, so there's a common Whitney constant for all of these guys. So suppose we're given such data. Okay, now let's assume that for any x1 through xk, there exist p1 through pk such that, and now apologies to the note takers, but everything is the same except here. I'm going to assume that if you look at the pi and you subtract from it the jet that it's supposed to be, then that belongs to m2 times the convex set that measures the standard of accuracy. That's the acceptable slop, and this is for I equals 1 to k. So I'll pause for a minute to allow notes to be taken. Just tell me when to restart. Okay. All right. So this is the analog of theorem 1, but with the assumption about jets and Whitney convex sets. And the conclusion is that there exists a function such that all of this, by the way, in the previous theorem, I think I said, but I didn't write, this C depends only on M and N. Thank you. All right. I seem to have done it right. I forgot that I did it right. Okay. This time I have to say something. All right. So part of what I'm going to say is that here I'm going to replace the statement about function values with the statement about jets. So jx of f minus what it's supposed to be belongs to the allowed slop for all x in E, where right, now I'm supposed to say what C depends on. C depends only on M, N, and the Whitney constant A. Okay, so that's the analog of theorem one for Whitney convex sets. Let me say a little bit about the proof. I have no chance to get in. I mean, the proof is a non-trivial thing. Let me mention one elementary and beautiful theorem on convex sets. I think you all know it, or almost all of you know it. And if I just remind you of the statement, then by pattern matching, you can just, I mean, it's completely clear that it has to come into the proof. It's Helly's theorem, okay? Helly's theorem says that if you are in, let's say, a D-dimensional space, D being, I mean, in fact, the space is the space P of polynomials of degree less than or equal, never mind. Suppose that you're in a D-dimensional space. Suppose you're given a collection of compact convex sets. Suppose you want to know whether this collection of compact convex sets has a non-empty intersection. It is enough to check any D plus 1 subsets from the collection. And if any D plus 1 of those subsets have a non-empty intersection, then the whole family has a non-empty intersection. That's a basic fact about convex sets in Euclidean space. And just by the sound of the words, it's obvious that that should, I mean, that it would be natural to use that in the proof. And so in the proof of Theorem 1, I think it's used 5 times, and in the proof of Theorem 2, probably additional times. And it's just, it's a standard trick to be employed whenever. Okay. All right, but I think now I should just leave CM omega and start talking about CM so that at least I will have stated the theorems. Okay. All right, so now we're talking about CM of Rn. So now here's the setup. This is the, remember from yesterday, the generalization of Whitney's classical problem. So we're given a subset E contained in Rn. Let's say it's compact. Doesn't matter. Let's take it compact. And for each X in E, I'm going to give you a jet and an ideal in Rx. Maybe it's zero, maybe it's the whole ring, but it's an ideal. And remember, these are particular examples of Whitney convex sets. So this is in accord with the ideology. All right. Fine. Now, all right. What we want to do is that we want to know whether there exists functions f in CM of Rn such that the jet belongs to f of x plus I of x for all x in E. Okay. The object of what I'm about to say is can one decide whether there exists such an f? Sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't, depending on the particular problem. Let me introduce a terminology. It's a slight variant of the Beerstone-Milman-Pawlewski terminology and a much less slight variant of standard technology terminology. So let's say h of x is the coset, and then the collection of all of those is called h. Okay. So I'm going to say that this thing is a bundle. I don't assume anything about how it changes from one x to the next. The dimension can jump. Two x's can be very close together, and this a, and a, you know, a, x1 and x2 can be very close together. H of x1 will have nothing to do with h of x2, but I'll call it a bundle. Okay, and if there's another one. Okay, if that's another bundle, then I'm going to say it's a sub-bundle of H if simply point-wise this is an affine subset of the polynomials, and if that inclusion happens, then I'm going to say that this is a sub-bundle of that. Okay? And I'm going to, and if this is true, if Jx of F belongs to h of x for all x, then I'm going to say that f is a section of the bundle h. And so the question is, do sections exist? Okay. In, you know, when one uses the words bundle and subbundle and section, you're used to the idea that every bundle has lots of sections, and that's obvious. But here, here the problem is, does there exist a section, even locally? Okay. All right. So if one can understand that, then one can understand the whether a given function defined on a subset extends to a CM function on all of Rn. Okay? All right. Now, in order to answer this question, one introduces the big idea. The big idea is Glaser refinement. Glaser refinement is a slight variant of the dual of what Beerstone-Milman and Pawlewski defined on for CM of Rn. I'm just going to explain this, but that is very much around in the background. Okay. All right. So what is it? Well, given a bundle H, its Glaser refinement is going to be a new bundle. Going to be a subbundle of H, and it's going to have two crucial properties. Okay, first property is that GH can be computed, and the second point is that any section of H is already a section of GH. Okay? That means that for purposes of trying to decide whether H has a section, I really can ignore all of H except GH. GH is the only part that might possibly be relevant. All the rest doesn't matter. Okay? Now, I feel I should say something to liven the discussion. I have just lied to you. Okay? The lie is the following. This may be a subbundle, but what it is guaranteed to be is what I might call a generalized subbundle. It's the following weird thing. Imagine that H tilde at every point is either a coset of an ideal or the empty set. Okay? Let me call that a generalized, for the moment, a generalized bundle. Okay? Then this GH is not necessarily a bundle, it's a generalized bundle. That is, these guys might be empty without warning. If they are empty, if even one of them is empty, look at the statement. Any section of H is already a section of GH. That means that at each point, the jet of an alleged section would have to belong to the corresponding subspace here. But wait a minute, that subspace is the empty set. So if you ever get the empty set as the Glaser refinement at any point, you're done, and the answer is there are no sections. If, on the other hand, you never get the empty set, then that's the case in which I did not lie to you, and GH is a subbundle, and the hunt for sections continues. Okay? That's the plan. Now, all right, maybe the time has come for me to give you the definition of Glaser refinement and check these two simple properties. Okay. Okay. So let's see. Let's say we're given a point x0 in E, and we're given a polynomial p0 in h of x0. And I have to tell you whether p0 belongs to that guy. Right? That will be the definition of Glaser refinement, if I can tell you that. So given that, we say that p0 belongs to h tilde of x0 if and only if the following thing happens. Now, the following thing involves a constant k in the background. K is a large enough constant depending only on m and n. And I can give explicit bounds for it, sort of like the ones before, only even worse. Okay. Right. So we say that this P0 is in the H tilde if and only if the following thing happens. Given epsilon, there exists delta. So far, so good. Such that for any points x1 through xk belonging to E and also within distance delta of the point x0, okay, there exist P1 in H of X1 through PK in H of XK, and these are the alleged Taylor polynomials of a section at the points X1 through XK, but we don't have a section, we're just trying to find one. Okay, there exist those guys. Those such that if you compare any two of them, this is less than or equal to epsilon times xi minus xj to the m minus alpha for alpha less than or equal to m, and I and j equal 0, 1 through k. Notice I'm allowing I and j to be 0. If I took them from 1 to k, they would have nothing to do with the x0, and we could simply take all these, well, anyway, never mind. Zero is included, and that's important. Let me try to convince you that with that definition of the Glaser refinement, these two properties hold. Okay. First of all, it can be computed. That's the argument there is the following. First, fix x1 through xk, can you find p's that do this? Well, you take this guy, you divide, you take the sum of the squares as before, and the question of whether you can find p's that do such a thing is, again, a linear algebra question. Okay? Can you minimize, what you're doing is minimizing a quadratic form over an affine space, over a bounded dimension, because k is simply a constant depending on m and n. So for fixed x1 through xk, you do some linear algebra. And then as x1 through xk vary, what's happening here is that just look at it. The x1 through xk are required to tend to the common limit point x0. And so having done some linear algebra, you then take a Lin soup. Okay, so this is explicit and computable. And I hope that statement is convincing because I haven't given you a formal definition of explicit and computable. Okay, so that's my pitch for saying that this can be computed. How about any section of H is already a section of GH? That's a precise mathematical statement, and it's trivially correct because whenever I want a polynomial in this definition associated with any point, I just take my section, suppose that the section is F. Then any time a polynomial is called for associated with some point xi, I just take pi to be the Taylor polynomial of F at the point xi, and then this property holds by Taylor's theorem with remainder. Okay? So I hope that I've convinced you that the Glaser refinement has these properties. All right. Where are we? There. All right. I'll try to finish up by 10 after. All right. Okay. All right. Now, all right. So where are we? We've defined Glaser refinement. We're trying to decide whether there exists a section. Glaser refinement may fail or succeed. Let me put it that way. If you get the empty set someplace, I'll say Glaser refinement fails. If you never get the empty set, I'll say Glaser refinement succeeds. If Glaser refinement fails, we know there's no section. If Glaser refinement succeeds, there may or may not be a section. What shall we do? Let's Glaser refine again. So given any bundle, H, we produced a new bundle, GH, and we can take G of GH. And then we can take G of H and so on. For any K you like, you can take G K times of H. And if at any point that process fails, that is, if you ever get the empty set, then you know that that there is no section. Now, wait a minute. We're in danger of doing an infinite amount of calculation because the K could be arbitrarily large. There is a remarkable, completely elementary lemma I wrote it down, but anyone who read Beerstone, Milman, Pavlovsky even a little bit would see it. And in turn, I think they got it from Glaser, who stated it in a very special case, but it's already, I think it's fair to say, in Glaser. And it's the following. There is a number, L, such that if you Glaser refine L times and you haven't yet hit the empty set, you never will. And in fact, from that point on, further Glaser refinement produces nothing new. The process of successive Glaser refinement stabilizes. Okay? So if you can get to GL of H, if you can get that far, then you're guaranteed that this is GL plus 1 of H, which is therefore GL plus 2H, and so on. You're done. You only need to go this many times, and the L is explicit. It's the dimension of P or the dimension of P plus 1 or something like that. Okay? And so I found it quite surprising, but it's quite elementary. The proof is a sort of cartoon. Well, here's a cartoon of the proof. Suppose that I had some machine such that you put into the machine a vector space and you get out of the machine a vector subspace. Well, if I tell you what the dimension of the starting vector space is, you really don't need to know how the machine works. You're guaranteed that after at most the dimension plus one or whatever it is, the machine produces the same thing, you know, as output that it got as input. And some slightly glorified version of that argument shows this. Okay, so so we keep trying to show that there is no that there is no section by taking repeated Glaser refinements, but perhaps finally we get to this stage and we have failed to show that there is no section. Now what? Now Glaser refinement does us no further good, and now I'm going to state the theorem. All right, so let me fix L to be that number L such that that happens. So here's the theorem for C infinity. Okay, so let H be a bundle. Okay. If Glaser refinement succeeds enough times to produce GL of H, an actual bundle, not the empty set, okay, then there exists a section. Not only that, but you can tell what the possible Taylor polynomials of this section are at one point. So, part B, suppose there exists a section then, given any x0 in E and any p0 in H of x0, there exists a section F of H of this bundle such that its Taylor polynomial at the given point is the given polynomial. This happened if and only if the polynomial belongs to the stable Glaser thingy of H at x0. So that's the meaning of this. It's the set of all, we've computed the set of all Taylor polynomials at x0 of possible sections of H. And finally, suppose we want to know how big the CM norm of a section must be, then we look for the following inequality. So suppose there exists a section then the inf of the CM norms of all possible sections has the same order of magnitude in the sense of last time, okay, as the best constant M in the following inequality, which is in principle computable by linear algebra. Okay? Given x1 to xk, remember k is our number depending only on M and N. Given x1 to xk in E, there exist p1 in the Glaser thingy at x1 through pk in the Glaser thingy at xk such that such that let's see, what? The usual. That and that. Again, for fixed x's, this best constant, the order of magnitude of this best constant is computed by linear algebra, and so to find the best constant in general, what you're doing is doing some linear algebra and taking a soup. If you compare this with the previous stuff, the new ingredient is that instead of belonging to the h, it has to belong to that. This gives me no chance to discuss the proofs, maybe that's for the best. Thank you.